This conference will now be recorded.
Welcome everyone to today's Performance Management Group call. Today's call topic is Future Hospital Finance, and we have a panel of speakers presenting today. Our Executive Director at the National Rural Health Resource Center, Terry Hill, will be facilitating today's call, so I will go ahead and turn it over to him.
Thank you very much, and good morning, everyone. The topic of the day is pretty much the topic of the industry, and that is as we're undergoing some fairly pronounced change, how are rural hospitals going to financially survive, even beyond survival? Are there possibilities that in the new healthcare system that is evolving, hospitals can actually do very well? And that's the topic of the day. We also, because this program is sponsored by the Rural Hospital Performance Improvement Program, as most of you know, we're funded by the Federal Office of Rural Health Policy. And kind of on the topic of the day, we're going to be looking at some of the financial and operational assessments that are currently being done. We're going to profile two of them that have been done this year, and we're going to look at both what have been the results of those, the processes and the results. And another question comes up is how have those assessments kind of positioned our hospitals to be successful in the what we're calling, it isn't really healthcare reform. We're kind of calling it market reform at this particular point. Healthcare reform very often gets into the, you know, do we support the administration and its health initiatives? Do we not, et cetera? And I guess part of the premise is that with market reform, it is somewhat dependent on you know, kind of the policies of the administration, et cetera. But part of the premise here is that the market itself is reforming, and that despite what one party or another might do, we're pretty much online to move away from the old system, which was based on volume, and move instead to a whole new system that's really going to be based on value. That's threatening for everybody. It's threatening for rural hospitals. I can tell you it's threatening for big healthcare systems, big tertiary care centers, et cetera. So, you know, one of the challenges we face with rural hospitals is that, you know, we don't have a lot of resources. We are able to change quicker than our urban counterparts. But at the same time, one of the things we think is going to be most important is that we're aware of what is happening, and we're aware of potential strategies that our rural hospitals can take kind of moving forward here. So kind of in that regard, we have three speakers, as Leslie indicated. Our consultant basically is one that we've worked with in this program. In fact, Eric and I did the very first hospital consultation down in Mississippi. Gosh, it's been about 13, 14 years ago. And so Eric Schell, who I know many of you know, is with the Stroudwater Group. Eric is just kind of one of the most influential people in rural health policy, without any question. He's got 25 years of experience in healthcare financial management. Joined Stroudwater in 1997. He's a frequent speaker at national and state healthcare conferences. In fact, I think Eric speaks more than anybody else that I know of on this topic of rural health finance. He's got just really extensive credentials, a degree in accounting from Penn State, an MBA from the University of Rochester, somebody I consider a good friend and have worked with frequently over the years. We also have two really good hospital administrators, two really stellar leaders. One from Doug Tanner is the Chief Executive Officer in Washington Community Hospital and Nursing Home in Chatham, Alabama, and he's got 22 years of experience in hospital management and 8 years of experience in private business management. He's been at Washington County Hospital since October of 2003, and he's also president of the Southwest Alabama Hospital Council. Tom Keim is the chief executive officer of St. Genevieve County Memorial Hospital in St. Genevieve, Missouri. He's been at that hospital since 2007, and he worked at Heartland Regional Medical Center before that for 12 years as vice president of marketing and business, et cetera. So both of these individuals have pretty extensive experience in hospital leadership, and we want to kind of call on both their experience and to get their perception of where the industry is going. And so I think we're going to start the conversation about the industry itself. And I think I'm going to start off with Eric Schell, who can give us just a little background about what is happening at the national scene and the market as well, and kind of the transition that he's envisioning kind of moving forward. And then I'll call on Doug and Tom to jump in whenever they've got the question. And those of you that are listening are also welcome to ask questions at any time. So with that, Eric, tell us a little bit about the message that you've been giving across the country as you travel from one rural hospital conference to another.
Well, thanks, Terry, and make me think that I only go around speaking. Yikes. I think the aha, Terry, you talked about market reform and how that's manifesting is right now there are many rural hospitals that are struggling financially or are beginning to struggle financially or beginning to see things different. I got an email or a phone call from a state office of rural health director up in the mid-Atlantic area yesterday. He wants me to come and give a talk in late August because he said, we got to move this thing up because I fear for the very small independent hospitals out there that the market's moving faster than they're in a position to move to. And so when we start talking about this market movement, what is it? And working with the Louisiana Hospital Association a year and a half ago, and then most recently last month with the Tennessee Hospital Association, that really affirmed and updated a lot of the content coming out of the Louisiana Hospital Work Group that set out to address what this market reform was all about. What market reform really came down to is the fact that it leads right into Michael Porter, the famous economist from Harvard, who back in 2004 wrote an article around redefining competition in healthcare. Any of you interested in the article, I think there's some copies of it floating around. But what Michael Porter talked about back in 2004, this article was published in the June Health Affairs article 2004, is he said that our competition is not the root of the problem in healthcare. Back in 2004, he said what we're competing on is the root of the problem. And what he said is for 30 years in healthcare, we've been competing on the zero-sum game of shifting the buck from insurer to hospital to patient, all resulting in no fundamental change to the biggest economic driver in healthcare. The biggest economic driver in healthcare, he suggested, was patient value as measured by outcomes. And what he said in 2004, when our healthcare system starts to compete on patient value and in a market competition, he said, we will see the transformation in our industry that we have seen in other industries like telecommunications or the computer industry, where we've seen significant improvement in technology and innovation at a significantly less cost. What's happening right now in our healthcare system is providers are starting to compete on this biggest economic driver, which are patient outcomes. Measured and they're publicly reporting, they're competing on their quality scores, they're competing on becoming more efficient, recognizing there's no new dollars. And we're trying to, and folks are really starting this open competition, which I believe started around 24 months ago. And now I see it accelerating very quickly. And so some of the real challenges that we're seeing, one is the fact that it's moving fast. And it's going to continue to move even faster. I think I'm very concerned that many rural hospitals where the CEOs are saying, gosh, I got 3 more years to retirement, I'm going to ride this thing out, and not get very kind of proactive in terms of addressing what this means, are going to be faced with some very tough challenges. And specifically what this means is initially, as this manifests in terms of lower patient volume, both inpatient and outpatient volume, lower payment per unit of service, challenges around critical access hospital reimbursement. Ultimately, it's about less dollars. It's about doing less. It's about being more efficient. We've got to get more proactive in terms of how we become more efficient. So I said a whole bunch there, but I do think, you know, the big points are is I think we've entered a new healthcare world around competing in an open market competition around patient value. How that looks going forward, it's there's going to be a big play towards taking costs out. And until we transition the payment system, which we're starting to see now, we're going to be taking cost out, and cost is equal to revenue. Ultimately, we've got to get in the mode where we flip the payment system. We're taking cost out of our provider delivery system is going to result in additional profits. Anyway, there, I've said a lot. Terry, you want to help out, you know, add something?
Yeah, you know, in essence, in the new, it's generally referred to as a value-based system. And in the new value-based system, basically we're going to get paid for documented quality outcomes, documented patient satisfaction outcomes, and basically having done all this at lower cost. That's kind of threatening, I would think, for a lot of rural hospitals. But, you know, I see a bright side to this as well, because most of the money being spent in the healthcare industry is not being spent in our smaller rural hospitals. It's being spent in the bigger tertiary care centers. And in essence, what we realize is that, for example, surgery, which has long been a revenue producer, I just want to make sure that we're totally clear in that, is going to turn into a cost center. That in essence, we're going to be seeing a system where we are going to manage a group of patients, and it starts with Medicare patients. There's no question about that, but it will also include Medicaid patients. And then we think third-party payers are moving in this direction as well. So Blue Cross Blue Shield will follow suit, as they generally always do. They follow Medicare. And so what we're going to be doing now is managing the health of populations. And if we're good at providing good quality, and we're already outperforming the urban hospitals in patient satisfaction, so that's an advantage. And we're also lower-cost providers in the big tertiary care centers. Despite what you read, the documentation is that we spend less money on a rural Medicare patient than they do on an urban Medicare patient in Florida. So the opportunities are there as we're moving forward. Now, you know, it's one thing for Eric and Terry to say that, but I'm wondering about what about our hospital folks, Doug or Tom? Are you kind of seeing the same movement? If one of you will, how about you first, Doug? Tell us about how you see kind of the future of healthcare, or if you believe that critical access hospitals or rural hospitals in general are going to be able to pretty much stay the same.
Well, it's the future is rather daunting for all of us, I think, because of the uncertainty. But I happen to lean to the side of an optimistic viewpoint, because I believe that if we are well positioned, we're more nimble than the larger facilities. And this is one of the things that Eric talked about during our financial operational assessment, the importance of reeling our local primary care physicians in as tightly as possible, so that essentially what we have created is a small rural health system in our community. so that we then, if you know, with the advent of ACOs, which we've not yet seen in Alabama, but that we're able to not just simply have to be a contracted vendor facility in a network, but that we actually bring value to the table. I believe that we can do a better job, although we don't have the volume in some patient diagnoses. We're doing MBQIP and all of that, but those patients that we do see, I believe that we should be able to meet those quality standards. And I would argue that in the New World Order, to position ourselves, it's kind of like a beauty contest. We've got to make certain that our organization, our facility, what we do here, that our costs are in line, that our quality is as good as it can possibly be, that our patient satisfaction and the patient experience is maximized, and that we actually bring value to the table for an ACO or for some delivery system. They want us to be part of that of their network.
Yeah, that's
and
very
I would
well
I
said.
Would echo what Doug said as well, that you know, for the longest period of time we were focused on driving revenue, service lines, surgery, those things that we felt that, you know, were going to allow us to continue to grow. And we were seeing revenue growth, but what was happening to us is our margins were shrinking, our bad debt was increasing, we were adding expense, we were working hard, and we weren't, you know, we're not putting the money on the bottom line that we felt that we needed to. And with Eric coming in, you know, he had us really refocus on the things that we really could concentrate on and position ourselves for the new healthcare system, and that being, you know, the quality measures, and like Doug said, the patient experience, but the primary care piece of what we controlled in our market, which made us very attractive to be in a position to you know, look at ACOs and be part of some of the things that's happening with the payment system coming up. And we needed to go in and look at where we needed to trim some costs and could we be more efficient. We own all our physician practices, so we needed to be able to make sure that our primary care, we were getting the proper access to care, that we had the efficiencies in our operations, so that we had the ability to have a good primary care experience for our patients. And we're being transparent with the quality measures that we have in place. You know, we feel, and like Doug mentioned, that one of the greatest things we think we bring to the table is that we can move quickly, and we're not afraid to put it out there because we're treating our neighbors and our friends. And we want them to feel confidence that every time they walk into our facility, not only are they going to get great, compassionate care, but they're going to get, they can feel that they're in a quality operation and we've got it posted for them to see.
Boy, that is all really well said. In essence, what I heard is, you know, we don't have, at least I'm not sure where Missouri is, there are over 300 ACOs so far in this country. So there have been fewer developed in the Mid-South, for example. Florida has probably more than a dozen from what I'm understanding. But in essence, what I heard in both of your comments was, you know, we're not worrying about what's happening externally. We need to be as good as we possibly can be, because in a value-based system, it's going to be about value. And we've got to, you know, be able to demonstrate that value, that as well. It's not going to be enough to say, you know, we're the safety net provider and we don't know what's, you know, if we're not here, it's going to be a catastrophe for this town. We recognize that's the case. But in essence, we're getting thrown out into a whole different world now, and it's really going to be about documenting the value. And what I see in both your statements is that you've begun that process of being as efficient as possible, of being able to document why you would be a good player in the system. Because in essence, it's not going to be in the interest, you know, one of the good news sides of this, folks, is it's not going to be interest in
big medical centers to suck in all the patients into their urban centers anymore. What they're going to be looking at is going to be how can we keep people locally, and how can we partner with hospitals that are extremely efficient, and whether that's the opportunity not only to survive but to be able to have some autonomy in terms of the future of your hospital or your local healthcare system. One of the things I want to go into a little bit deeper, because it's really critical here, is the whole primary care physician base. And both of you mentioned that kind of locking up your primary care providers is extremely important. Eric, you want to talk a little bit about why is that the case? Why is suddenly primary care partnerships so important for rural hospitals?
Great, thanks. Ultimately, as we start to play out what population health payment means, for those of you who've been around for 15 years in the healthcare, it's essentially is a capitation or some form of budget-based payment. And what happens here is that rural hospitals, we talk about the value of rural hospitals. Terry's led into a little bit about that. The rural hospitals that have aligned with their primary care physicians have incredible value because, and it's right in the regs that were posted on the ACOs, is that a patient is going to be assigned to a primary care physician. And if you think of an average primary care physician with 2,000 patients assigned to them, if you take the total cost of healthcare in this country and divide it by the population, the cost of healthcare is around $7,500, somewhere in the $7,500 per patient basis. If we have one primary care physician that is part of our system, our rural system, that one primary care physician has a value somewhere around $15 million. I think, Tom, you probably have, 8 or 10 primary care, maybe 10 or 12 primary care physicians?
We do.
Tom, if you do the math there, Tom has... in the future, so a future economic value of somewhere between $150 and $180 million of revenue opportunity with a cost system that is below $50 million. And so when we start talking about the value of rural hospitals, those that are aligned with their primary care very, very tightly have incredible revenue relative to cost. Flip that around and look at the big urban centers that have spent the last 30 years maximizing the fee-for-service system by investing in the specialists and the technologies and all the surgeons. And they've essentially spent 30 years investing in the cost centers of a future payment of the future evolving payment system. When rural hospitals will start to really understand their value when we're going to be approached by these larger systems looking to aggregate those $150 million of revenue and very little cost of our rural health system. And so I think that truly is one of the great values of rural. But it really is those that have aligned with their primary care. And let me just say one more thing, Terry. Aligning with your primary care does not necessarily mean that we employ them. There are some primary care physicians in your community that are going to be independent till the cows come home. They are going to just stay independent. Well, that doesn't mean we can't be aligned with them. And I like to talk about a model of alignment where you think of a stool with three legs on a three-legged stool, and the first leg is contract. So can we have a contractual relationship if it's not an employment? Can we lease space? Can we have a contract to provide medical directorship? So that's one form of the leg of the stool around contracts. The second is function. The second leg of stool. Can we have relationships that are functional based? The greatest example of that is shared EHR. What do we have to do to get our shared hospital IT system into our primary care practices that aren't necessarily employed? And then the third leg of this is around governance. And involving our primary care providers in our governance systems, having them more involved in strategic decision making and in board involvement and operations involvement. The fear obviously is that if we just have one of those legs of the stool and not the other two, that at some point in the future, when the larger systems all of a sudden start to throw the money that they have to develop a network, they can just go after and just outprice, outpay for our primary care physicians and take them from us, which essentially our linkage to them is our value. So hopefully that, another mouthful there, Terry.
Yeah, Terry, this is Doug. I wanted to kind of make one comment on something that Eric said. One of the other benefits, I guess, that I see from if having the primary care physicians very tightly aligned, it's my understanding that in the ACO legislation that a hospital could participate. In our case, we're about 65 miles north of Mobile, Alabama. There are four major hospitals there. If all four of those hospitals started an ACO, my facility could participate in the network of all four, but a primary care physician can only participate in one. And so if that remains to be the case, if we have our physicians pull so closely to us that we are essentially a cohesive system, it positions our hospital, the collective group, but especially the hospital, to be able to negotiate the best arrangement with whichever ACO offers us the best deal. And the other three are left on the outside looking in, and they have no presence in our county, which to me is crucial.
Yeah, that's such an important point too. That in essence, knowing our value as rural hospitals and some of these basic strategies is absolutely going to be essential. And if we were going to put one thing at the top of the list, I just personally would probably put that as number one. We haven't talked much around the other side of that, and the other side of it is that simply, if there are a finite number of primary care physicians, and what I can tell you is we are not anticipating any huge increase because of the shortage of residency programs. In other words, primary care residency programs all filled almost the first day this year. I mean, it used to be that a lot of these primary care residency programs didn't even fill, or they were kind of the last resort. Or if they couldn't get into, you know, a specialty they love, they jump into the primary care program. That's totally turned around. The medical schools and the residency programs are way behind on this as well. So in essence, even though we've got more medical students going in to medical school, we're now actually finding that some of the medical school graduates can't even find a residency program. And so in essence, we're not going, at least in the short term, unless we can increase the number of residency programs nationally in primary care, we are going to have a finite number of primary care docs. And so the backside of this is if you don't make the partnerships or these arrangements, and yeah, you don't have to employ them, you simply have to have this understanding, this business relationship with them. But in essence, what will happen, we're almost sure, is the ACOs that are urban-based will come in and basically give them offers they can't refuse. Already we know that the primary care physician salaries are going up substantially. They're up in the mid-200,000s at this point. That may seem catastrophic under the old system, but under a new system, as Eric pointed out, we're going to be able to pay for them if we can survive this interim period as we're moving forward here. If we can somehow lock in the physicians, develop our value statement, put us in the position where we can basically negotiate with any of these emerging ACOs, you know, then we're going to be strong. But on the short term, We do risk losing our primary care provider supply, and they're going to be very difficult to replace. Some of the Medicaid states have adopted the expansion of the Medicaid program, and part of the assumption on healthcare reform had been that the expansion of the Medicaid programs would provide the basis of paying for the uninsured, and that has certainly happened in some states, but in a lot of states it hasn't. Let's talk a little bit about Medicaid. What is happening there? What are your thoughts on that?
let's kind of bring up this topic. Eric, you want to start out? What's going on in Medicaid?
Well, you see, not necessarily around expansion. I'm more interested in the delivery system that's evolving as a result of this. You look at, I think Alabama has taken a model that I think is right on, and it was modeled after the Oregon model, in which the state has identified five regions in the state where they're going to move forward with some type of essentially a form of a budget or capitation at the delivery system. So the delivery system is going to be aggregating without the insurer as the middleman. So the providers are developing these regions to take on a Medicaid capitation. Now, to me, that's kind of very, very innovative. It's going to be a pulling together of the hospitals and physicians around care management. I think it's the right direction to go. It's going to kind of get us to start thinking about a different payment model. I look at other states, for example, other states have gone towards more of a primary care medical home concept where the physicians are going to be responsible for kind of wrestling out the costs. I believe Arkansas has gone in a model that way. I'd be a little bit more concerned about it because essentially we are going to be pitting primary care physicians that are already tapped and swamped with what they're doing. Their focus, obviously, at this point is on high volume, low payment services, and they're going to be pitted against hospitals. There's a lot of very interesting and innovation coming in around the Medicaid delivery systems. Like I said, I'm a big fan of what Alabama had. Love to have Doug share his thoughts on that.
Sure. Well, our legislature passed the bill this past spring, and our governor has signed into law this Medicaid reform bill that will, as Eric mentioned, will result in the formation of five what we're calling regional care organizations throughout the state. Those regional care organizations will be separate and distinct, yet we expect that as the formation goes forward, that there will be a number of shared services that the RCOs will come together on. For example, in engaging perhaps an insurance company to provide us with some of the claims processing type of data that they're already equipped to be able to do. But as Eric said, then in each RCO, the Medicaid agency will pay us on a monthly basis, pay that RCO an actuarially determined amount each month to provide the care for the Medicaid recipients in that RCO. So we're going to get a fairly quickly find ourselves in the crucible of population health management with arguably the most challenging group of patients that you could try to do that with. Fortunately, Medicaid had already started. We have now four sort of pilot projects on case management for the Medicaid population here in the state. We were the fourth one in Mobile and Washington County, and Medicaid is paying a small fee each month to what are called patient care networks. And those patient care networks have set up case managers, social services types, people and they're targeting through claims data, they're targeting right now the Medicaid patients that are in certain high-risk diagnosis categories, diabetes, congestive heart failure, and really trying to engage with those patients and get involved in a lot of what's going on with them and driving their healthcare utilization. I was meeting with the head of our local patient care network recently, and she was sharing some war stories with me, success stories that they've already had of patients that they found that were on, you know, 24, 25 prescription medications, some of which were variations of the same medication. They've been able to eliminate some of those. And it's also caused that, though, you began to have to drive and drill down into some of the socioeconomic issues as to why that may drive utilization. One gentleman, it gets very warm down here in the summer months, and they began to notice that in about April, his frequency of utilizing the emergency room just spiked. And case manager went to his house and found out he had no air conditioning. So they paid $350 and bought the guy a window air conditioner, and nobody's seen him in an ER since then. So it's really going to force us to change the way that we think, and our viewpoint on these patients is going to have to expand beyond just seeing them in the office or seeing them in the hospital, and take a more holistic approach into all of the elements that come into play with their medical and their healthcare status.
Yeah, this whole concept of we'll now get paid to manage the health of populations, and you know, it looks like Alabama's kind of leading the way from the Medicaid program side of it. Let's talk a bit about the Rural Hospital Performance Improvement financial and operational assessments, let's start with Tom. Tell us a little bit about why were you interested in having participating in this program, having Eric come in and working with you. Give me a little bit of background about what interested you in it, and then talk a little bit about the process itself, what happened.
Okay. Well, having been here, I'm in my seventh year. When I first came, we did a five-year plan, and we had just completed our five-year plan and brought together our physicians and board and management team to begin work on our next plan and our strategic plan for coming. And like I said earlier, we're getting great growth in revenue and service lines, and everything seemed to be, you know, headed in the right direction. At that time, we were looking at expansion of surgery, but we're in the process and had our plan coming together, but we were seeing shrinking margins, bad debt was increasing. Like I said, we were doing a lot of work. Revenues were growing very nicely along with all our ancillary services, but we weren't putting anything on the bottom line. We had had access to people from RHP in the past, and actually I'd heard Eric speak at several conferences, like was mentioned earlier, we felt that if we could get a grant through RHPI for Eric to come in and really take a hard look at us, look at our plan, look at our strategy, really kind of take a deep dive into our operations and our cost report and our revenue cycle, things like staffing levels, all the areas about improving the efficiency of our operation, and having a large employed physician base, we really needed somebody to come in and look at how could we maximize the efficiency there, the profitability of these practices, put in place some things that would position us to strengthen our primary care hold. And we felt that, you know, we had some other things that we were dealing with that like to upgrade our computer system, whether or not to go to a hospital system, some of these things that were really kind of wearing on us that we had been kicking them around, beating them around. We felt we had consensus, but we needed somebody just to come in and say, this is where healthcare is headed. You know, our experience with RHPI in the past they've been very innovative. They really are up to date where the healthcare reform regulations are going. The consultants we've had in the past have always been very professional, and we've gotten a lot out of them. They have access to a lot of consultants, and really we felt that in some of the pieces that we've had in the past and projects with them, their approach to process improvement would help us align our strategic plan with what we were capable of doing. And Eric came in and had some meetings. We really flushed through and really kind of took apart our strategic plan, and he helped us kind of refocus in areas that were going to really deliver for us the biggest bang for us moving forward with our strategic plan.
And were there certain areas of improvement that you set out? One of the things about our program from the very beginning, and we have to really, I need to credit a lot of this to our staff, Bethany Adams and Rhonda Barkas are both just really excellent at what they do. And we've designed this thing so that there is a process, an extensive process up front, and then a very measurable outcome on the back end as well. So we think we're, you know, in order to justify the money being spent, we are in the process of documenting value as well. So part of that is due to their very good work. But as we're moving through on this, we look at coming in, there were very tangible, as I understand, goals in terms of better financial performance, et cetera. It wasn't kind of like, oh, they're going to do better afterwards. It seemed to be very specific in terms of what we're trying to produce and what we're trying to quantify as outcomes. It's obviously been just a short time since this has happened. But what have you witnessed, Tom, in terms of kind of outcomes to date?
We're very early in the process, and Eric was here, and we finished up in mid-May. We're in the process of we've had a complete overview with our board. We've engaged our executive medical staff in meetings where we've got it planned with our entire medical staff at the upcoming medical staff meeting this month. We've had employee forums. So it's an ongoing, updated weekly meeting that I'm having with our directors and managers on the key initiatives. We have key drivers that we're updating and making sure that we're on the timeline. So many of the specific action steps that we put in place, we are meeting those goals and deadlines. I don't have the financial numbers to report at this point with June closeout. I should have them for our board meeting next week. But we've seen positive increases in obviously the physician clinics on our primary care. We're restructuring some of the contracts to incentivize our physicians on that part of primary care. I just don't have, we're too early to really kind of give you any update on success of the plan. I can tell you that from being transparent and educating our entire system on where we're headed and what are the things that we're working on, that's the point that we're at right now is the education, the involvement, and getting everybody rowing in the same direction, so to speak.
Yeah, and that's so important as well. Do you feel that you're better prepared for the future, kind of that you've established targets that are going to be appropriate and beneficial if the industry is in fact changing?
Well, I think that's what the greatest benefit that we had is the exercise we went through with Eric is really taking it and setting definite action steps and timelines and benchmarks so that we knew we were on track for each of the initiatives that we felt these were going to be the things that we had to be hitting on to position ourselves for the future. So we're on timeline with every, and actually Eric left with nine. We've since had a couple that we've added to it because we underwent the Meditech upgrade to our computer system. We've got ICD-10 coming. We know we need some updates to our social media marketing and our employee satisfaction. So we have added four additional items to our overall plan initiatives that we're hitting. but it helps us feel that we're hitting in all areas that will make and deliver what we need to be doing to position ourselves for the future.
Terrific. Eric, do you have any comments to make on your experience there?
Well, I think the beauty of working with St. Genevieve was the fact that there was opportunity because of the way they had, I believe, Tom, you had four or five physician primary care clinics. We had surgery. There was all kinds of things, lots of good stuff. And Tom's organization employed most of the primary care physicians. And so there was really, he was already positioned to kind of move towards the future. And a lot of what we were looking at with Tom, it was just tweaks to all the good stuff that was already going on.
Doug, tell us a little bit about what was the motivation for doing your assessment, and talk a little bit about what happened, if you will, please.
Well, we had our introduction to RHPI in early 2004, shortly after I arrived here, when Eric came in and did our initial performance improvement assessment. I think Mary Gio kind of supplemented him and worked with him on that. And our experience from that that initial engagement was so positive, because the action plans that came out of those, the recommendations from that first assessment, really gave us a roadmap to be able to make some incredible strides in improvement here. I mean, for example, we completed a fiscal year the day before my first day of work. And in that fiscal year, our facility had a combined total of 221 swing bed days. And after our initial PIA, the work that we did through that, we have grown that volume to in the neighborhood of 1,600. And so it is pretty remarkable. And so that now, 9 years later, as I began to look at this whole spectrum of healthcare reform and kind of scratching our heads, and because we are an independent rural hospital, we have currently no alignment, no affiliation with a larger system, and we've been thinking and talking about that at the board level and below as to what the future holds. Do we need to be looking at some alignment? And that was sort of the impetus for me. The assessment that Eric did kind of goes back to the comment I made earlier about this being a beauty contest. Help us to get ourselves positioned, not only just to survive today and to be able to do as well as we can do, but then to position ourselves so that we can seek out those types of strategic alignments. And as Tom said, we're so early in the process that I don't really have anything to report yet, but we have taken those action plans. Our action plan team has been formed. It's a fairly fluid group because of some of the initiatives that we have not only involve our hospital, not only involve our clinic, but we also have an affiliated 88-bed nursing home. So we have work going on all over the place. And the day that Eric was here to present his report and work with our action plan team, one of the things I really wanted him to do was to make a presentation to our board. And I know it took a chunk of the day. A one-hour presentation turned into 2 hours, but it really heightened my board's awareness of some of the challenges that we're facing. But I think if there has been one outcome, I can certainly see that among my leadership team that they feel better that we at least have a plan of attack of how to ramp up in some areas where we have opportunity to improve. And we have made an agreement with our board that part of our agenda every month will be at our board meeting last month. I came back to them with the action plan that our team had developed and the timelines, and that would become a monthly part of my administrative report to update them on where we stand with regard to the rollout of those initiatives.
Doug, I'm really glad you brought that up. That's just another area that so often is overlooked. We have hospital boards that, these are folks who live in the community, they've got their own jobs, et cetera. And meanwhile, we have this incredible change going on in the healthcare industry. And frequently, because I work with hospitals all over the country, I'm hearing more and more our boards don't really understand what's happening here.
we'd like to make changes, but I just don't feel they're behind me on this particular thing. So that whole education of boards is going to be incredibly crucial coming up. And I'm glad you mentioned it, because I think it's something that, if you look at what is really fundamental to future success of rural hospitals, I would certainly put that up as something extremely important. Without the board's understanding and support, it's going to be very difficult to make the kind of changes and the kind of, develop the kind of value statements that we're going to need.
Terry, it's fascinating to me that that so many boards, and Doug's board is one. It was a great, we had a great lunch meeting with them. But there's so many boards out there think that they know something's different in healthcare. They see it in their financial statements. They see it in some of the discussions. And what they are thinking now is, often, is that if we can just, once we repeal this Obamacare thing, it's all going to go back to normal. And the fact that's probably not the case, that what's changed is what the level of what we're competing on, as I introduced earlier, where from the zero-sum game of shifting the buck to true patient value, the biggest economic driver. If we could get boards do understand competition. Most of them are in some type of a business or a farmer that they ultimately have to compete. They understand competition. And you can see the eyes light up when they start to see that it isn't just about Obamacare. It is about a true change in the competition in healthcare. And then they can start to say, okay, we've got to get on board and start to really, call out new actions and call out new direction, and not actions, but direction. And Doug was right to say a plan of action, a plan of attack to address some of these changes that we're seeing is absolutely critical. And to the extent that the boards understand why that's happening is pretty much just as important.
Well, and one of let me add too that one of the unlike many hospitals or honestly like more than they're willing to admit, we have not had a strategic plan here, and that was one of the things that my board is now we're considering the board is considering engaging. Eric or someone from Stroudwater to come in and actually help us with that process. It was interesting. I presented that idea at our last board meeting, and it's amazing that some of my board members, in their mind, what the definition of a strategic plan was, it all had to do with building something, adding something, on to the building, expanding beds and that's no longer the environment we're in. I mean, once upon a time, I've had strategic plans that where you were adding new services and expanding the size of your facility and adding beds, and that's probably not necessarily reality now. It requires a different level of ingenuity of thinking so far outside the box that you can't even see the box anymore to figure out what you need to do in your unique situation to align yourself, put yourself in the best position to be able to survive and compete.
And I would just echo that, too, that we've been doing a lot of board education for the last really 2 years on quality measures and core values and things that we are tracking and trending in the facility so that as we're moving through the quality pieces of this that the board members are understanding that we are going to be being paid on quality and value to the patient and the patient experience. And those are things that are standing board items for us as well. The action plan on our strategic plan, the board scorecards, we have department scorecards. Our managers are tied into tracking and trending as well. And we're holding them accountable for the quality measures and patient satisfaction.
Excellent. Does anybody have any who are on the line? Anybody have any quick questions for any of our panelists Again, it's star two if you do. If you do have questions after the call, or you'd like additional information or anything of that nature, please contact Leslie, and we'll be happy to send it to you as well. We only have a few minutes left, but Eric, you've got this. I hate to bring it up at the very end, but you've got this analogy of the or the metaphor of the shaky bridge. Can you talk a little bit about what you mean about the shaky bridge for rural hospitals?
Sure. In the last minute and a half, we're going to give a two-hour presentation on crossing the shaky.
Well, perfect. It's your Eric. Challenge, bud.
This is going to be my presentation in New Orleans, if anyone's going to be at the Mid-South conference. But anyway, really the shaky bridge is about, in today's day, today what we've got is a payment and delivery system perfectly aligned. In a fee-for-service payment system, a churn and burn, a grow volumes to create profit is clearly the strategy. I say today, but I would probably say that only because I don't think we're there anymore. I think we've moved beyond a pure fee-for-service payment system and then a delivery system that's based on a volume growth. The future, the other side of the shaky bridge, this other pillar, is a payment system that's based on population health. And this is one that's about lives. And it's about bringing out cost of the care of lives to create profit. And anything in between, as soon as we step from that fee-for-service pillar where price times volume equals payment, as soon as we step out of that, what happens is our payment system and our delivery system are no longer aligned. And what I mean here is that if we take on a Medicaid program, which is 15% of our payer mix, that is now paying on a capitated basis, what do we do with our delivery system structure? Do we change our delivery system structure to just look at Medicaid patients, or do we change it completely going towards more of a population-based care program where we take utilization out? As soon as we do that, we're on a shaky bridge, and that shaky bridge is really shaken because ultimately the delivery system is now taking utilization out, and as long as utilization is the payment mechanism for 75% of our payers, our financial statements are really going to start to move. So the analogy of the shaky bridge is you got a fee-for-service pillar, you got a population-based pillar, in between is a bridge that's very shaky, and as soon as you step out on it, the key is to get across it as quickly as possible. And maybe the next call we can talk a little bit about some of the strategies. I'm actually here with a colleague in northern New Hampshire working with four critical access hospitals that have seen this coming and are actually proactively designing a mechanism, an implementation matrix to get them across the shaky big as quick as possible. Maybe we can do a next call on that one. But I think we're already over. So, Terry, I'd hate to spend another hour talking about that.
No, that's an introduction. So, in essence, basically the concept is that we've got to survive in the current payment system, preparing ourselves for the journey across to the new system, which is going to be very different. We heard a little bit about it today. We also heard quite a number of the strategies, basic strategies that have been suggested. One is make sure your boards understand what is happening, where the industry is going, and can help to make informed decisions and provide support into the future. Another one is we need to really form partnerships. We've got to align with our primary care physicians, absolutely essential. The third is we need to be as efficient as possible, and that's a big part of what the Rural Hospital Performance Improvement Program is about, helping rural hospitals kind of maximize their effectiveness and their efficiency kind of moving forward. And another one that wasn't mentioned, we can talk some other time, is the whole, there's a whole formula for care coordination, actually reaching out to the community, working in partnership with long-term care providers, the mental health industry, et cetera, et cetera. So those are some of the concepts, some of the strategies that we've talked about. What I can tell you is that the future of our rural hospital performance improvement program will provide all the support that we can in the consultations, in the education, et cetera, to support the approximately close to 200 hospitals in our 8-state region moving forward. I do encourage you, those of you that are listening, to contact us if there's something that we can do to tune in to future education, et cetera. And we're committed to being as effective in providing as much value as possible, kind of getting with the program, so to speak. Although, I think this, hopefully our RHVI program has been dedicated to that from the very beginning. I want to thank our speakers. I thought this was a great discussion. It's a discussion that I can tell you is taking place across the country, and we need to have more of them. We'll follow up at a future date. Again, I want to thank Doug Tanner, Tom Keim, and Eric Schell for being part of this. I want to thank Leslie, who does a terrific job here all the time and make sure that all the details are covered and we're as efficient as possible as well. So thank you, everyone, and we hope you participate in our future events as well. Bye-bye.
The moderator has disconnected.